491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week for episode 303, recorded on April 12th, 2020, from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And rejoining us on the line from the Washington, D.C. area is Greg, Master of Public Health, our former co-host of the show. Hi, Greg.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back.
We're continuing our coronavirus-related coverage here on Arsenal for Democracy, but as always, attempting to focus on the big picture. This week, we're going to be talking about the economics of hospitals. We'll talk about the big hospitals, the rural hospitals, the hospital networks, all of that stuff, and what the pandemic is underscoring, we'll say, about things that we pretty much already knew were problems with hospital economics in the United States. And I guess the challenge here is that there's been a lot of very bizarre discussion in the United States about how supposedly, you know, a single-payer universal healthcare system wouldn't save us from having all these people die, and they point to various European countries that have other compounding issues without also addressing that the results may in fact be worse in the United States as a result of not having that. We've got all these different interacting dimensions here. The hospitals themselves being privately owned and how they are privately run and operated and so forth, or sometimes they're nonprofits, quote unquote, but essentially still structured in the private way. And then there's also the issue of how people themselves pay for getting care, whether they have a way to pay for getting care, which obviously is a bigger picture thing than just COVID-19, as we will talk about. All of these things are interacting together, but we can also see that in some of the other countries, there have been similar problems the closer they are to the United States model. So the idea of just saying, well, other countries are having problems too, is not necessarily very helpful or illustrative. So I guess, Greg, where do we start on this topic? Because it is a pretty big, wide-ranging topic. Where's the place to dive in on this?
I think that one of the best places to dive in is this report that hopefully we can share with the audience. Trust for America's Health annually puts out a report about our nation's preparedness for bioterrorist acts and pandemics and things of this nature, of this time. And it was, I think, mostly a coincidence that they released their annual report for 2020 at the end of February, and then the COVID-19 pandemic, as we know it, really kicked off. But basically what that report gets into and what that report has gotten into over the years that it's been released is that the healthcare system is woefully unprepared for things of this nature, the COVID-19 or bioterrorism and the like. And this is something that a lot of people in the public health community have been sounding the alarm about for a number of years. And now with the COVID-19 situation, we're seeing these kind of fears come to fruition. And I think that a lot of what we talk about is these structural issues that are really underpinning our healthcare system and make it particularly susceptible to pandemics of this nature. And, you know, I think the primary thing is that we exist in a healthcare system that is for profit, that is privatized, and that many of the other countries that have fared better in the world have different healthcare systems. Maybe they're not entirely nationalized like the United Kingdom's is, but that they operate in a more publicly nonprofit oriented way. That I think is better in general for public health because it prioritizes the goal of a publicly funded healthcare system is to make sure that people are well. The goal of a privately funded healthcare system is to make money. And making money is not necessarily conducive to preventing a pandemic.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the comparison to the UK because they are also obviously having some pretty severe challenges right now. A lot of that has to do with decisions that were made by the Conservative government or by years of both major parties in the UK making poor budgeting decisions and things like that. But it's maybe misleading for Americans to look at that and say, well, see, this proves that having a universal healthcare system doesn't actually solve things. Because in fact, under the influence of Americans, there had been a big push to privatize the NHS, or at least aspects of the NHS, going all the way back to when Margaret Thatcher was in office in the 1980s. There was an interesting article in Novara Media, which is an independent media outlet, by Joe Sutton Klein, who's a junior doctor in Sheffield and has an MSc in social epidemiology. And Joe Sutton Klein wrote, since the 1990s, the UK's healthcare provision has been subjected to increasing marketization, in particular through the so-called internal market, introduced by Margaret Thatcher, this system splits the NHS into purchasers and providers who must trade with one another. Initially, Thatcher's arrangement simply split the providers of healthcare from newly created purchasers who commissioned services for specified populations. Over time, the internal market became increasingly entrenched, resulting in an unwieldy, marketized arrangement of NHS services. Within hospitals, different departments and services function as financially separate entities, and hospitals themselves are forced to compete with each other to win contracts from clinical commissioning groups, CCGs, in the local area. By mid-March of this year, many elements of the internal market within hospitals had been put on hold as some wards had stocked up on personal protective equipment, leaving other wards in the same hospitals short. The purchasing and distribution of COVID-19 supplies was instead centralized within hospitals, meaning purchases no longer needed to come out of ward or department budgets. Since then, the procurement of coronavirus supplies has been centralized nationally, with the government coordinating daily deliveries of supplies to hospitals. The internal market of the NHS relies on the individualization of healthcare, enabling it to become a commodity with value attached to the benefit medical intervention brings to an individual. But the health of individuals is always a consequence of or contributor to the state of society. In essence, all health is public health. It's just a shame that it's taken the coronavirus pandemic to make the government realize this. And I mean, a lot of that, I think, echoes what you just said, Greg, which is that anytime that the goal of providing healthcare is to make someone a buck here and there is going to lead you to a different way of treating people and a different set of outcomes for people than a system that doesn't have that. And we're seeing the UK having to make an emergency pivot from last year having secret talks with the United States to fully privatize the NHS to suddenly suspending all internal privatization mechanisms, or at least most of them, because it simply is incompatible with providing public health. Meanwhile, as this article also noted, the United States either lacks the capacity or the political will or both to be able to make any sort of transition like that. So here we are, criticizing the UK for their response while just being wholly incapable of having a different response from the perspective of how our hospitals provide care.
Yeah, I think that to the extent to which that the UK has failed in responding to COVID-19 is not emblematic of universal healthcare or a nationalized healthcare system, but is instead actually indicative of the shortcomings of privatizing the healthcare system, even in the kind of minor, or at least in comparatively minor ways that the UK has done to the United States, which is essentially wholly privatized. I mean, even to the extent that like Medicaid and Medicare can be private through managed care organizations that provide for Medicaid beneficiaries and Medicare Advantage. Privatization, and I've beat this drum on this podcast, this radio show before, is not how we achieve optimal health for anyone, any in any country.
The comparison that sprang to my mind as I was reading up on some of the problems with the UK is look at how Amtrak is run in this country, right? That's nominally a nationally owned passenger rail service in the United States, except that the political leadership in the government has required Amtrak to attempt to operate, or at least parts of it, at a profit, and is constantly trying to make it operate within market parameters in some way, as opposed to just having a publicly owned, publicly governed rail entity that isn't supposed to operate at a profit. And I think that's kind of the approach that had been taken in the United Kingdom, that they have these publicly owned hospitals that are being governed from this conservative market-oriented perspective, even if they're still publicly owned. The other thing, of course, similar again to Amtrak, is consistently not providing adequate budget for the level of service required. That has been a persistent theme in the United Kingdom as well. I mean, that's a challenge that I think a lot of the European countries are having too, is that austerity, years of austerity over the past decade have put them in a position that their once really good public healthcare systems are a lot closer to the level of inadequacy that we see in the United States, which again is not a criticism of public healthcare provision. It's saying that you need to do a better job of it and provide it with more resources, which certainly isn't going to be achieved through the private system. Rachel, there were a couple of articles by Dr. Abdul El Sayed, a former candidate for governor of Michigan in 2018. Also, I think he used to head the health department in Michigan. He had a new book out, so he was doing press for that. But it's related to the pandemic stuff anyway. It just happened that he had finished a book on the problems with the private healthcare system in the United States. I was wondering if you could talk, Rachel, a little bit about some of the comments that he made. There were a number of aspects that he talked about, the just-in-time economic structuring of hospitals, the consequences of not having a universal health insurance system on the side of, how the patients get access to care, essentially.
I think a huge part of the failure in our response is this just-in-time supply chain, both in like our public health lab or in a hospital. We are discouraged from having bulky inventories. It's seen as like a waste of money because the equipment just sits in storage and doesn't get used. But now we're seeing that we have to have these inventories of PPE or ventilators or whatever, just for these surge conditions. And once everybody's demanding a ventilator or a mask or a gown or whatever, the supply chain seizes up and then we can't get it. We've run into this at our lab. We're waiting up for weeks for reagents and other supplies just because everybody's demanding them at the same time. So a nice bulky inventory would look really good right about now. Also, another aspect that he mentioned is that we've been trained to ignore symptoms. A quote from him, it's never good that 10% of your population has learned not to see a doctor when they have nonspecific symptoms that are the same as what this disease produces. There's a whole part of the population that's learned to ignore a fever and a dry cough because that might mean a bill on the back end. I know we've talked a lot before about how many people don't have like any emergency funds or are living paycheck to paycheck. So people can't afford to go to urgent care or the ER or their doctor, for the people lucky enough to have a doctor, when they're having these kind of nonspecific, somewhat mild symptoms, just because they can't afford the bill that comes a few weeks later. So I think definitely a public health system, whatever that looks like, would definitely kind of push us away from that thinking that, oh, I'll just ignore it, it might go away, sort of thinking that a lot of people are trained to do. Even people with insurance just can't afford co-pays or deductibles or whatever that would come if they did go to the doctor. Yeah. For these kind of non-specific symptoms.
Now, Greg, another thing that Abdul El-Sayed had written about in, and we'll have all the links up to all these articles we're referencing, as usual, at arsenalfordemocracy.com when the episode goes up. He talks about the way that, which you have kind of alluded to this, but he talks more specifically about the way that hospitals make money, because, again, they're mostly geared toward generating absolute profits as opposed to not being intended to be a profit-making institution. And he says that a lot of what has happened as a result of everything kind of shutting down that isn't related to the pandemic is creating financial havoc for even the hospitals that had traditionally been quote-unquote moneymakers.
Right. So one of the ways that hospitals, and this is true not just of hospitals, but of healthcare providers in general, make their money is they do kind of procedures. And so as maybe a brief primer on kind of payment models, there are some obviously nuance to these two categories, but there are essentially two types of payment structures and how to pay for healthcare. And then one is fee for service and one is sort of like more value-based care. So in a fee for service payment model, every single thing that you do for a patient, whether, you know, you have a 15-minute consultation with them or you perform an echocardiogram on them or anything in between, has a specific code that the provider then bills the insurance company for, and then the insurance company pays for that specific procedure or service. Whereas in a more value-based care system, a global budget system, that a provider will receive a lump sum of money for the amount of people that they have to care for. They receive a capitated payment, a certain number of dollars per capita that they're responsible for, and then they can do with that money what they need to do in order to make sure that that particular patient is cared for. And the problem with a fee-for-service system that we are seeing is that it, because providers get paid per service, per procedure they do, it's incentivizing unnecessary procedures, unnecessary services in the pursuit of money. And so when we see a pandemic like this, even the hospitals that were really, really good at billing for all of these procedures, and that's why they were so profitable, if people aren't really coming into the hospital because they're afraid of getting COVID-19, they're not able to bill for procedures and they're no longer able to be profitable. So this is a major flaw in the system. We've even seen privatization go away from this in recognition that it's incentivizing wrong things. So we're seeing, you know, I talked about managed care for Medicaid a little bit earlier, and there are managed care organizations that are responsible for a set number of Medicaid beneficiaries, and they receive X number of dollars in order to provide care for each of those beneficiaries. And whatever they need, that's what they get. And so we're even seeing private companies really kind of realizing that fee-for-service isn't the answer. And I think that a situation like this where there is just this treadmill of people, they're just constantly hoping that a treadmill of people are going to come in and out of the hospital, and they're going to need particular services that they're going to be able to bill for, and that's how they become profitable. That's not really public health. That's really just money making.
Now, on that note, one of the things that I think we've talked about, you know, years back on the show, probably when you were co-hosting, was this issue of rural hospital finances. And for some reason, there was a lot of criticism, you know, of Medicare for All type stuff, of saying, you know, oh, somehow this is going to create various, you know, financial problems for rural hospitals that are already in bad shape, and this is going to be the death knell, et cetera. You know, a lot of that had to do with the compensation models for doctors and other healthcare workers under Medicare for All. But a lot of this, I think, was not really a genuine expression of concern. This was people basically doing flim-flam arguments where they combined various things together and tried to, you know, say that X would cause Y, when in fact the rural healthcare system in this country is completely collapsing under the private model, and it seems pretty clear to a lot of us that only public ownership of the hospitals themselves, without even getting into the issue of national health insurance, is the way forward. It seems like this is also starting to, as we just said, affect some of the, you know, wealthier urban hospitals that were generating a lot of money. But could you talk specifically about the rural hospitals, both in the current context and also the broader context outside of the pandemic?
Sure. So currently, rural hospitals aren't really that attractive for providers and even to be set up because they're not money-making. There are not that many people that are coming in, so there are not that many services or procedures that they can bill for. So there's really kind of limited access in rural locations for hospital services. And this is true for all providers, not just hospitals. And so what we're seeing as a criticism, like you said, of the Medicare for All is twofold, in that one, it's people that really haven't read the bill and they're just assuming that Medicare for All, and this is probably a problem with the name, is going to take current Medicare compensation rates and then just apply it to everyone. And that's not what most of the bills, I don't think that's what a single bill that has been offered, and there have been a number, has suggested. There's a health affairs article by Christopher Kai and James Kahn. It came out in December of last year. And the current status quo that they say is that private insurers are paying 1.4 times the average hospital's operating cost, while Medicaid pays 0.868 and Medicare pays 0.881 times operating cost. So the current situation is public insurance pays a lot less money for hospital operations than private does. That's, I think, what a lot of the resistance to Medicare for All, particularly for rural hospitals, because people go, oh no, what if rural hospitals didn't have access to private health insurance anymore, that they get 1.4 times their operating costs, and they only had access to like basically 80 to 85% of public insurance. That would mean that they would have to close. I think this is disingenuous, like I said, because the Medicare payment levels would be increased. They would not be as high as private health insurance because there is a lot of extra administrative costs associated with private insurance because there are so many different private insurers. So you could pay, if you had one single payer healthcare system, maybe 1.1 times the operating cost, and then get rid of all of this administrative cost of having to bill Cigna and United Healthcare and Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield, and you could still provide services for a lower amount of cost. And then the second thing is that it's, like you said, ignores that there really isn't that good of a rural hospital healthcare system right now. And it's like we said, it's because there's not a lot of people in rural settings.
One big thing is, for example, that any piece of equipment you have, say, gets used by fewer people in a rural setting than it does in an urban setting, just because of the geographic density or lack thereof of the population. So anything that requires, for example, you know, some piece of specific equipment, or even talk about human resources, say a doctor that has specific training in some particular field, they're going to see fewer patients, which makes it, in terms of economies of scale, a much bigger cost, you know, because you're not getting as many patients through. That's one example of a way that the rural hospitals' density problems become a challenge from a non-public ownership model of a hospital in a rural area.
So I think that the solution to this is to, and then this is the solution that Kai and Kahn offer in the health affairs article, is to move to a global budgeting system. So like I was talking about earlier on a kind of micro level, that there are two different payment systems. There's fee for service, and then there's the, you know, value-based payments. Instead of having a system that is privately funded and pays per service. What if we had a system that was publicly funded, like some of the Medicare for All proposals that we've seen, that provided hospitals a set budget per, you know, their purported or estimated people that they're going to serve and their levels of care that they will that they will need. And I mean, it seems very straightforward to me. I do see that one of the main criticisms of that is, how are we possibly going to determine how much a global budget for a hospital should be, particularly in a rural setting, when like their people are so far apart, it's not really clear what their service area is and whatnot. And I'm not going to say that I have the actuarial skills to know exactly how to set up a global budget for a hospital in rural Montana or whatever, but I know that there are people that do. And in fact, I know that there are people that already do this, right? It's and I think that we also need to kind of disabuse people of the notion that if there's privatization, it's very straightforward, there's no red tape, and public nationalization means that, you know, there's a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of red tape. There are people doing these calculations right now about how much healthcare costs. We can divert them from doing that for private companies to doing that for the government. It's I'm not saying it's relatively straightforward, but there are people with the expertise out there that can figure out what a global budget is for a rural health, for a rural hospital.
All right. Well, we're almost to the end of our time. Rachel, I will go back to you now for thoughts on any of the stuff that has come up today, especially since you're the only one of the three of us who is in a more rural area. I mean, obviously, you live in a city, but like it's a more rural area service area than either of us lives in.
Right. So just kind of anecdotally, I had to talk on the phone with a hospital lab employee in a rural hospital. And I was just kind of asking her how things were going. And she actually pointed out that a lot of the employees were getting their hours cut. And it was because sample volume for every other procedure that's not COVID-19 has been dramatically reduced. And so I think that's another problem with this kind of privatized healthcare system is they're actually not as nimble and aren't able to move people around because they are kind of constrained by this profit seeking. So I think it's kind of scary to think of people actively losing their jobs right now because their hospital, like the administration, sees them as too expensive or too much of a burden on the profit margins. So I think that's something else that is pretty alarming, just the fact that hospitals are cutting staff right now and cutting hours of what staff they are keeping on. So that's something else that's not as compassionate as a public not-for-profit system would be.
As usual, our articles will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode comes out. We always put it out as a PDF. Rachel, thanks for being on this week again.
Thanks, Bill.
And Greg, thanks for coming back on the show to talk about this area that is within your wheelhouse more than ours.
Happy to have an opportunity to talk about this stuff, and I appreciate you having me back.